You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people.
I'm Howard Wallace.
And I'm Sally Douglas. Welcome to By the Well. This is Pentecost week 13, and the readings for this Sunday are Jeremiah 18, verses 1 to 11, Psalm 139, verses 1 to 6, and then 13 and 18, 2 to 18. Then Philemon, the whole thing I think you should just read. And then Luke 14, verses 25 to 33. We're going to be focusing on Jeremiah and Luke with a tiny little detour into Philemon. Howard, let's talk about Jeremiah.
Right, this is the third week we're into Jeremiah.
Yeah.
Still a few to go. And this week we're still in a very early stage of Jeremiah's prophetic activity. We're in chapter 18 and the rather well-known, possibly well-known, image of the potter when he goes down to the potter's house. But we need to put it in a little bit of context first. A couple of weeks ago I said that Jeremiah began at about 626 or 628 BCE in the reign of Josiah. Mm. Josiah was said to be, at least by the Book of Kings, a good reforming king, and he gets a very positive sort of press in that context. But things are either going wrong in Jeremiah's time early on, or people are getting too confident in the reforms that Josiah has been undertaking. Because in this passage, chapter 18, verses 1 to 11, with the image of the potter, we find judgment starting to, well, still coming on very strongly from Jeremiah. So we're in early days and things, according to Jeremiah, are not going as comfortably as others would say. And later on we'll find Jeremiah facing people he regards as false prophets who are pushing the sense of hope for the future, whereas he wants to say something quite different. And so we've got this reflection. He goes down to the potter's workshop and watches the potter work a pot, because God has told him he's going to see a message within that context. And the potter's pot doesn't go the way it's supposed to. The potter reshapes it into a new thing. It's all about change, and particularly in that first image, change in God's heart and mind.
Yeah.
And ultimately also change in the human or Israel's life and activity.
It's a particularly beautiful image of the pottery. If people have done pottery, they know how hard it is. Well, I've done it and it's hard. And you can think you've just got it working and then the whole thing goes sideways if it's slightly not centered in the correct way or so on. Mm. And so that notion of working and reworking would have been readily known for people living in villages where there was a local potter. It's a beautiful image. It's quite a fluid image. And so this invitation into thinking about God who changes God's mind and the people's ability to change as well or not. It's a really interesting image here.
Yes. Of course, the lesson that Jeremiah is to take from this activity goes well even beyond the literal sort of understanding of the way the potter works and doesn't work.
Yeah.
Because within the metaphor, the potter, of course, is God.
Yeah.
And the people, Israel, are the clay that's in front of them. And, of course, there's limitations in real potting in terms of the clay doesn't have a choice of what's going to happen. It's always the potter. So there is the danger within the passage of thinking of some sort of determinism in a way.
Absolutely.
That God governs or what happens. But I think this passage really wants to underline, as it comes to at the end, where there's this call now for the people to turn, all of them, that there's a two-way sort of street going on here, that God reacts to the people's action.
Yes.
And the people need to respond to God's action. There is always a chance of hope for the future. But unless they turn, then that hope will be wasted.
Yeah, I think that's so important to highlight, and particularly because in our wider culture, if people have any notion of prophecy, it's often in a much more determined kind of concept in, you know, science fiction or fantasy film and so on, or in popular imagination generally. And so this notion of prophecy, not as fixed about what is going to happen, but about an invitation to change now and to wake up to what's really going on.
We often get sort of a misunderstanding of prophets because we use it in a very sort of foretelling sort of way. And yet the only places where you get that in the Bible are in some of the what's called the Deuteronomistic history, Deuteronomy, Samuel, and occasionally in Kings. And even then it's history looking back as to what was said and what has come to pass. Whereas if you engage with Isaiah and Jeremiah.
I was about to say,
Isaiah, It's more social critique, we might call it, where we're really sort of naming what's wrong with the society at the moment or what's right with it in some occasions and saying what the consequences are going to be.
Yeah, and being invited into into change, so waking up to what's going on and waking up and then making the changes. I think that's really important to underscore. And, you know, I can't help but think maybe the clay has a bit of animation, like in the same way that sculptors sometimes say that they didn't sculpt a piece but it emerged from the marble or so on.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you're picking up on Michelangelo and stuff like that.
That's right.
And releasing a figure from the stone and stuff. But, I mean, that... It's a nice thing to think about too, because you can think, well, in the clay itself, there is something that is of value to be brought out and shaped.
Yes.
And that's the way that maybe God is perceiving humanity.
Yeah, I really love that. And so even in sometimes in Jeremiah, this language of, you know, plucking and destroying, it's not for its own sake, but it's in order to bring about the the new thing. And so the clay itself isn't destroyed, it's remade. And so, yeah, the bringing out the essence of what was already there, I think that's a beautiful idea.
Yes. Well, this is the second, well, it's the first time that those verses from Jeremiah's call back in chapter 1 have been reiterated, the plucking up and destroying and then the planting and giving life to. They're going to come another four or five times later in the book as well. So there's this constant theme of first must come a pulling down of what is false and what is wrong. But ultimately it's the planting that really is the message at the end.
Yeah, and God's continuing longing for them to turn around. And it's interesting that part, that verse 12, where it's not part of the reading where the people just say, it's no use.
That's just a bit beyond the reading for this week, unfortunately. And I think scholars sort of debate of whether this is a sort of a willful act on the part of the people. They're not going to listen at all.
Yeah.
Or whether it's inevitable. Yeah. You know, this is just the way they are and they're never going to break out of their ways.
Yeah.
Did you know you could join our Facebook group, By the Well, for extra content and discussion?
So I just, before we jump into Luke, I just want to jump just for a second into Philemon or Philemon, however you want to pronounce it. I just think it's a gorgeous invitation to read this text. And maybe if you weren't doing it in worship, it could be like a study group. It's such a tiny, short text. And it's this window into Paul and him writing to someone saying, look, can you release this person as a slave? And, of course, it's become a really important text in terms of questions about slavery and how much does Paul question slavery? It doesn't look like he does question it too much. But it's just this amazing little invitation into early church dynamics, because there is this really interesting claim about he's no longer a slave but free in Christ. So this notion of there is no slave or free, again, kind of surfacing in the letter about what does it mean in political terms and practical terms to be a follower of Christ? And it actually changes the fabric of relationships. So not necessarily preach on, but it would be fun just to read it as a group or to take it in turns, just to hear this living voice, I think, back from really early sources, and to have a discussion about it, how we react to it, what do we think happened, how Philemon felt about it, how Onesimus felt about it. Like, it's a really interesting text. And then at the end of it, Paul invites himself to come and stay if he gets out of prison. And I always wonder if how Philemon felt about that, if he was glad or not that he was arriving. But I just, it's a really amazing little text, and it hardly gets any attention. So it could be a great thing to do. But let's dive into Luke 14. Now, as we open up to this text, let's remember that it's going to be, in Australia at least, Father's Day. So what do we talk about fathers in this passage, Howard?
Yes, unless you hate your father more.
It's a pretty – I remember this happening a few years ago in the lectionary cycle, that this landed on Father's Day again. So it's a pretty – well, I think you have to address it.
Yes, definitely. Absolutely. Because these are hard words, and it paints a picture of Jesus that is not always a comfortable one for people.
Absolutely. Yeah. Particularly if they've been brought up with images of gentle Jesus. And, you know, imagine if you came to church for the first time that day and you're hearing Jesus say, hate, not just. So in Matthew's version, it's different. In Matthew 10, it's whoever loves father or mother more than me, which we can kind of get our heads around a little bit more easily.
I think that way, the words love and hate, I think, have taken on a certain shape within our own society, and that which is very emotive and emotional.
Yes,
not always the same in the ancient world.
Yeah,
I know, particularly in the Old Testament, but also in the Old Testament world, right across the world, the words love and hate can have other meanings and can be used in quite unromantic or unpersonal sort of circumstances. They can be used in treaties, for example. Mm. You are as a vassal, you know, the lesser party to a treaty, you are to love your master.
Yes.
And to hate the master's enemies.
Yes.
And in the sense of you are to give allegiance to your master or to the suzerain and not give allegiance to others. So I think we need to sort of qualify those words. Matthew seems to make it a little clearer to me.
Yeah, well, when he says, often Matthew does, I think.
Less. Love them less.
Yeah, you know? I think that word allegiance is really important here, because it's unlike so many leaders down through the ages who say, follow me and I'll fix everything and it will be great. Jesus is so honest. Like, so it says that we're told large crowds are following, so he's really getting popular. Mm. And imagine a lot of those people were there because they just want a sticky beak, or maybe they want someone healed, or, you know, hear something interesting. So he turns around to them, and instead of saying, yep, you'll get all the good stuff if you follow me, he says, actually, it's going to be really costly and you need to think about it. And, you know, like he uses the imagery of war, you know, you plan the war, or you plan how you're going to build the tower. You need to think about whether you really want to do this, and then refers to the cross, which is would have been curious if Jesus said this before the cross. It would be like, what are you, you know, what are you talking about? But this notion that it's costly, and it means that you have to shift your allegiances, so that even if it means upsetting your mother or father or your family unit, you need to be prepared for that upset in order to follow me.
I think so. You've got to remember a couple of things. One, that Jesus is on a journey to Jerusalem.
Yes.
And we know what that means.
That's
from
right.
Our perspective. He's been on that for a few chapters now.
Yeah.
So the cross is at the end of it.
Yeah.
And the other thing I think it's worth thinking about if you're going to preach from this passage is the nature of families themselves.
Yes.
Now, I think we need to be aware that families in New Testament times are not the nuclear little families.
Correct.
And so there's a wider allegiance, and there's different, even as there are in other cultures today, there are different relationships between members of families and different nature of allegiance within that family.
And then, different dependencies as well. Like to mean to not give allegiance to the person who actually makes sure that there's food on the table or protects you, that's really, really costly potentially.
Yes, and to not give allegiance may mean to put the whole family at some sort of risk.
Absolutely. And we hear this with, you know, within the early church, people who are being arrested and parents coming to say, can you please renege this faith? Like, seriously, it's putting us all in jeopardy here. Mm. So, you know, Perpetua and Felicitas are examples of that. So this notion of it is costly. And so I think for us, so at least in the Australian context, where we know our families are not going to be dragged off to the courts because we're a Christian, thinking about what's the costly nature of us. Because obviously in lots of places in the country, in the world, that is the case. Like, but what is the costly nature of discipleship for us?
So in that culture, I mean, there's something maybe more serious, more life and death risking.
Yeah.
With in terms of family and family allegiance and leaving families. But also, even if we do think of our own families, these are places of nurture, they're places of security, of comfort, of sort of belonging and acceptance, sometimes no matter what you do in that sort of context. There are all good things about families in that context. And is this passage sort of saying, you know, if you're going to follow me, Jesus, is there a willingness to let some of these go if they're, which they can be maybe not destructive in a negative sense, but they've been captivating.
And kind of cocooning or suffocating.
Are you willing to change?
Yeah. And then on the flip side, for those people who have not had that kind of experience of family as a nurturing and safe place, I think there's still an invitation, because as humans, unless we do a whole lot of internal work, we will have our parents on our shoulders, whether we're 90 mm-hmm. or 30, whether they were kind or unkind, going, oh, what would they think? And I think part of the challenge of this reading is to get them onto an equal place with ourselves in our mm. hearts, love and respect them, but our first allegiance being to Jesus. You know, what would Jesus call me to do? Yes, or what am I being called to do here? James Allison, an interesting theologian, calls parents that we're invited to see them as siblings, like intergenerational siblings.
Mm.
And I think that's a really powerful dynamic shift from constantly thinking, what would they think, whether it's the parents or whether it's the, you know, the wider family, to what is God calling me to do? So that's an ongoing call.
Yes. And actually, in a way, both the readings we've looked at, the Jeremiah and the Luke here, speak about change and willingness to change.
Yeah.
In relation to God and in relation to Jesus in the New Testament.
Yeah. So on this Sunday, it's Father's Day, so thinking about some of the themes, I always tend to, or I always acknowledge those secular days in worship, but I not in some kind of celebratory way, but neither in a doomsday way either, but just hold the space going, today will be a day of great celebration for some people, honouring their dads or their mums if it's Mother's Day, remembering them. For some, it will be a day of grief because they've lost mm-hmm. their dads, or their dads are alive but they're not in good relation, or they're not caring, they haven't been dads to us, or we've wanted to be a dad and haven't been able to, just to name the myriad ways in which the day could be landing for people. And just right at the beginning of worship, and then saying, you know, God longs to meet us as we are, not as we feel like we should be. And we're going to explore what hating our fathers means today. You know, you can, yeah. How would you approach the text for preaching?
How would I approach the text for preaching? Well, I'd start with Jeremiah, but
yeah, bring in clay for everybody.
Yeah, I wouldn't be so keen on making too much of Father's Day in that sort of context. But the other thing, I think there is a sense of hope in both of them.
Yeah,
I mean, you're invited to change in both texts in various ways, but that change itself is a point of hope, even if it might not be an easy sort of experience, as the whole reference to the cross here.
Absolutely. And I've just, as we're finishing up, I just noticed that Luke, again here in Luke, the ending is to give up all your possessions. And this was a few weeks ago as well. We can't avoid it in Luke. So I think continuing to have those conversations as individuals and as church communities about how we live into the radical generosity of Jesus is integral.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.